to the FAIR Data Forecast, Andrea Volpini.
Well, thanks, Alan, for the invite. I'm excited to be here today.
And I'm just wondering how you got started with this years ago. I know WordLift has been around for several years. When did it start?
We incorporated the company about 5 years ago in 2017. And I was coming out of research work financed by the European Commission on semantic web technologies applied to content management system. I've been working on the internet since the early days, the mid-90s. And I specialized in web publishing platforms. After the internet service provider phase, where it was primarily about connecting people, and then I began working on creating platform for publishing content on the web. And then as we started to grow with the complexity of the data that we were managing and the web started to evolve and become more and more a place where people could find different type of services with rich data, then I started to look for a solution for organizing this vast amount of content. One of my previous company worked on the content management system for the Italian Parliament. And so as a parliament, you deal with a lot of proceedings and laws and different steps of the legislative process. And so as we were creating this content management system, we found in deep need for a standard that could allow us to add metadata to this vast amount of content that, made the website so important in these years. I mean, we're talking about 1998, year 2000, so very, very early phases of the digital ecosystem for public administration. And so all of a sudden I started to look at, the founders of the World Wide Web, Tim Berners-Lee, as a source of inspiration, as he was, asking people to converge into this vision of the semantic web. And so the first research programs were really, in 2009, 2010, I think at that time I was working with some university here in Italy and try to find different models for, letting people organize ontologies or, specific knowledge domains and publish, alongside with content, also data on the web. Mm-hmm. And so that's how I got started, really.
Yeah. And so a lot of our readership will be familiar with quote unquote structured data that's in relational databases and not so familiar with the less structured information that you're well versed in. Can you paint a picture of the bit of the metadata landscape that you're a part of and how that fits in with the more traditionally structured tabular data?
Right. So continuing a little bit with the story of how we got into SEO and into creating a platform for building knowledge graphs. We were dealing with the content management system with all different type of databases and people were, kind of reaching out and trying to go with something that would be published on the web, because of course it became immediately clear that if you had If you represented a, you know, a group inside a large organization, you needed to be, you know, facing the public on the web. And this was, you know, in the 2010, 2011. But in order for you know, tabular data to be represented as web pages, we needed to create some level of mappings between the content management, you know, the fields, the structured content, and, you know, whatever was available in the databases. And so we started to deal with the problem of mapping data in and out, and also structuring web pages that that could represent you know, these data. And then, you know, we realized that the web could actually become a large database, and could be, you know, rather than made of web pages, it could be made of, you know, tabular data that could be connected and made accessible and computable by using, you know, some standardized form of metadata. So linked data was born. Now, linked data is a metadata standard that allow us to, on the open web, to describe, you know, the same, you know, data structure that we might have inside our own databases, but we make it accessible in a web format that enable the open data movement in these early days. So we move from, you know, the semantic web into the linked data standard with the idea of creating a metadata layer that could be interoperable on the web, because of course metadata had been existed starting from the first XML files, and then of course within the content ecosystem, you know, standards like DITA where, you know, providing a solution for people that wanted to, you know, label the fields inside their systems. But linked data was making this possible at web scale, and brought forward the idea of creating these vocabularies that would describe the data in such a way that other could understand it and compute. And the vision of the semantic web was also introducing the concept of agents. So AI that would reason over these web data. And so in 2011, with this research project that I was involved with, we started to create a prototype for WordPress to help people publish these linked data. And of course it was immediately clear that there was a potential within the context of SEO, because at that point Google and Bing and other commercial search engines were also realizing that in order to crawl and make sense of the web, they needed a layer of interoperable metadata, and they could tap into this, you know, linked data standard and make use of it in a simplified form.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And so we've been on this journey with search engine optimization for these search engines for over 10 years now. How has it changed over that time?
Right. So first projects that we've done with WordLift were very hard to prove because, you know, we were forcing the client to not only work on a metadata that was, you know, accessible to a third party that wouldn't give evidence of how they were going to use this metadata. And, but also, I mean, it was a pretty massive work to start, you know, working on these new emerging standard called schema.org, because immediately, you know, the concept of the semantic web that had been until now being used within the context of research groups or university, academic work in general, became a standard of the web. And so people had to cope with the idea that, you know, they had to understand what is a linked data vocabulary, because schema.org is a linked data vocabulary. So it's interoperable. It has, you know, its own taxonomy. Its own taxonomy. It's a structured, and there was no proof on how the search engine were going to use these additional metadata. But for us, coming from, you know, the experience that we had and the vision that Tim Berners-Lee gave us, it was clear that it was a turning point in the web. And if it was, you know, in the 90s, it was important to publish web pages in order to claim your existence. Then in the beginning of, you know, 2011, 2012, it was important that you also started to publish some metadata in order to exist. Mm-hmm. But there wasn't a proof of the padding in a way. It was very hard to justify, you know, a semantic project, at that time.
Yeah.
And also I've been,
just to give you an example of just what you're talking about and see if it resonates. Back when I was at PricewaterhouseCoopers group, I'd talk to data scientists in that group and I'd say, well, why aren't you using the structured data that is in these linked open vocabularies? Isn't that going to help you with your data science goals? And the question back to me was, how is that different from Wikipedia? And did you ever develop an answer for that kind of question? Or
I think that at that time, the work that was done inside communities like Wikipedia, DBpedia, and then eventually Wikidata, mm-hmm. was foundational for the development of the web of data as we know it and use it mm-hmm. today. And so we ended up in working on Wikipedia more than we expected because of these, you know, similarities that you described. And in a way, at that time, our claim was to let user build their own Wikipedia using structured data. So it was clear that a formalized structure could help any publisher mm-hmm. affirm and create its own or authority on the web, much like Wikipedia did. And then eventually this kind of connection between the schema markup and the Wikipedia community continue over the years until the point where, you know, when Google started in 2012 to create its own knowledge graph, they started by ingesting, you know, Wikipedia, and then eventually started to create facts from, you know, data that they could crawl from the web and using structured data and data that was coming from a free base. There was this large, knowledge base created to structure content. And so there's always been, a strong connection between Wikipedia and structured data, but we always position, even in these days, structured data as a way of creating your own Wikipedia, because you might not be eligible to be on Wikipedia, but you are eligible for creating your, you know, graph. And then at that point, also, you know, we evolved and started not to talk about linked open data, but we started to talk about knowledge graphs. Because in 2012, when Google introduced the Google Knowledge Graph and, you know, the famous motto from string to things, then knowledge graph became a concept that a lot of people could understand.
Exactly. And there's been a lot of development over the past decade in the area of knowledge graphs, and of course, people have different things in mind when they use the term knowledge graph. Can you talk about how the word lift conceptualization of knowledge graph differs from others?
We have been first in looking at these linked data stack in the context of search engine optimization. Mm-hmm. So on the SEO front, at that time, there were very few people talking about structured data. Mm-hmm. And they had to start thinking about knowledge graphs only in 2012 when Google, you know, created its own knowledge graph. But before, in the SEO industry, there was no notion of entities and concepts. On the semantic web front and on the ETL sector or in the sector of information extraction and knowledge management, people started to create knowledge graph for addressing, you know, use cases that were way more complex than SEO. So the world of people building graph databases was primarily focused on finance and, you know, a few other sectors where it would be, you know, easy to justify an investment in a knowledge graph. WordList has been the first to say, okay, well, we can use this technology that we call knowledge graph, which is actually the evolution of the linked data stack, mm-hmm. to do SEO. Why so? Because at that point, for me, it became very clear that what we used to call optimization for search engine was actually a data curation activity and a data publishing activity. So if I had better data and if I was able to publish it and make it accessible to the search engine in the most interoperable form, which seemed to be, you know, the linked data standard, then we could create an edge for our clients. But of course, in the early days, it was very hard to prove it because, you know, it was unclear how the search engine would use it. But as soon as the knowledge graph arrived, then it became evident that schema was having, you know, a benefit which was explicit. So you could see the impact on the SERP because of the rich features that were presented when you were using specific mockups. And it was also impacting on the implicit level by helping you, you know, supporting some synthetic queries. A basic example was if you would ask a CEO of WordLift using structured data, the search engine became capable of creating a synthetic query for Andrea Volpini and combining the results coming from, you know, the query about Andrea Volpini with the results coming from CEO of WordLift, and therefore creating, you know, a more accurate representation of results for that query. And so these are implicit mechanics that, you know, made it possible to prove that there was actually an ROI. And in the first year, I was very, very conscious about talking about ROI because we couldn't add enough, you know, evidence of what was this ROI. I mean, was really ROI there? Would it justify the cost of setting up a knowledge graph? And then, you know, right now, you know, 10 years after, I can say, if you give me $1, I give you at least $3 back in terms of additional traffic that I can create. This is not applicable to each and every website. So it depends on the vertical. It depends on the data that you have. It depends on the data that your competitors have. But my clients get at least a 3x return of investment.
And so, and what's the thinking? What's the thinking behind that 3x factor? Can you tell us how you got to that figure and what it means in terms of articulated results?
Yeah. So, in the COVID phase, we had to redefine our offering, and we started to more aggressively work on the e-commerce vertical.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason was that e-commerce was booming, and it became, you know, an opportunity to do SEO in the commerce space also, because Google wanted to fight against Amazon for, you know, getting the attention on all of these transactional queries that before were only, you know, the interest of Amazon. And so Google started to open up the organic results to e-commerce sites by providing free listings. So even though I had in the roadmap support for e-commerce site during COVID, we had to, you know, accelerate at a tremendous pace, you know, the support for e-commerce, because Google was going more into these queries, and there was tremendous demand because of people, you know, staying at home. And so at that point, in order to, you know, evaluate the impact, it wasn't just about clicks and impression as it was before, but I also had the opportunity to look at the purchase order on the pages where we apply our advanced linked data markup. And so we started to work on A and B testing on, you know, with the data science team from the clients, to evaluate the impact not only on the search traffic, but also on the actual purchases. And then we could see, you know, that in terms of additional sales, we could create an impact.
So can you talk about the metrics that might be relevant to what you just said, from the side of the customer who's seeing the ROI impact?
So of course, calculating the ROI on a editorial website, it's a mm-hmm. completely different game,
right?
Because you have to take into account how the website is monetizing traffic, and mm-hmm. and therefore in that context we would feel more confident to look at the increase on the organic traffic. Mm-hmm. But again, we would apply, you know, A and B testing and causal impacts in order to make sure that we can isolate external factors, because the problem is that at that point, we started to sell SEO as a product, which is what we do now. And so in order to sell it as a product, we had to, you know, we had to work on the way in which we could measure this impact. And if it's an editorial site, we have to look at the clicks and the impression, or any, you know, web metrics that the client is measuring. In some cases, it can be, I don't know, the number of tickets that the client is selling with his editorial mm-hmm. content. In some other cases, it can be the number and the quality of the leads that they are acquiring through the organic channel. So depending on the use case, we have to be very clear on, you know, what can we measure. And of course, not every site is a good fit, because if your monetization strategy are not strong enough, we may not be a good solution. We might be too expensive.
Mm-hmm.
On the contrary, if you are, let's say, generating leads at, I don't know, 30 euro per lead, then organic can do these 3x return. So depending on the business value that that the traffic creates, then we are, you know, capable of looking at, you know, the impact.
Yeah. So I might be back with you on some examples that explain what you were just talking about there. And we're half past the hour, so I was going to take the remaining time just sort of unpacking you know, we've been talking on the enterprise side here for the most part. What about the personal side? I help run this personal knowledge graph working group. I started it with George Anadiotis, who has published a book with Ivo Velichkov on that topic. And so our thinking was, to begin with, that We need to get more people involved in thinking about knowledge graphs and how to contribute to them, if they're, regardless of whether they're actually building them themselves. There was the phenomenon of Rome research and the networked note taking. Ivo was keen on how to do his own structured version of that kind of note taking. So much of that book has to do with use cases like that. But I sent you a sort of a story about a comic who is just getting started and they want to do their own promotion and have their own web presence. And for those kinds of people who are just trying to bootstrap their own brand, how does this kind of thing fit in with what they're trying to do? Is it too much of a stretch? Is there a place where they can land that's easier for them? What would you say to somebody like that?
We have a lot of cases like that on the personal branding front. We have created, as a matter of fact, a strategic partnership with Jason Barnard and Calicube, specifically to address, you know, the personal branding area. And let's look at a few cases that we've worked on in the past. Matt Arts is one of these anthropologists that does a very interesting research on how anthropology can impact user experience studies. And he came to us after listening to a podcast by Jason Barnard to say, hey, can I build a knowledge graph on my website? And would these help in creating a knowledge graph panel and therefore providing better, you know, stronger authority in the academic sector as well as in the business sector? And we've been working with Matt since then. And I met him actually for the first time in real life a few months back when I was in New York for the Knowledge Graph conference. And I had the pleasure to invite him because besides being, you know, a brilliant researcher, he has been also, you know, following on the strategy on building a knowledge graph on his own personal website and promoting his personal podcast on anthropology and UX. And he had seen what this has created, because of course, as soon as he got into the Google Knowledge Graph, he had been able to get more visibility and to grow his network. So building a knowledge graph is not per se an enterprise effort, quite the opposite. I mean, everyone should create a knowledge graph, much like everyone should create a website. How can this be done? In a way, the practice is similar to the information architecture strategies that you would apply to your own project. Mm-hmm. So are you going to create a section about your comics books? Are you going to create a section about your biography? Are you going to create a section about your, you know, other projects? How are you presenting yourself to others in a digital ecosystem? Mm-hmm. I mean, in a way, we're back to the point where Ted Nelson started, you know, how do we connect things? How do we connect concepts? And so we have a lot of these cases where people, individual came to us to build the graph, and then they have seen the benefit of building a knowledge graph because Google have been able to recognize themselves. But I mean, very basic example, if you look at myself, You know, I'm called Andrea Volpini, but there is a very famous, worldwide famous tennis player called Andrea Volpini. And then there is an Olympics champion and swimmer that is also called Andrea Volpini. And then there is a musician called Andrea Volpini. I mean, even with an Italian name like mine, there are at least, you know, four, you know, well-notable person with the same name. So how do we help the search engine understand who's who? And does that create an impact? Well, sure it does, because you can ask now to the search engine, how old am I? And, you know, what are the organizations that I have contributed to? And what is my mom's name? Or and of course, if you apply these on a creator or on a top manager, you're going to see a tremendous impact.
Yeah. And I even remember back in the day, and maybe this was in the 2010s, just before or after Knowledge Graph was announced at Google. I remember filling out a form to disambiguate my web persona.
Right.
And
right.
So they were reaching out to users, individual users, to do that at that point.
Yeah.
And now it's possible for you to just do that sort of thing yourself and do it your own way. Correct?
Yeah. I mean, we've done a lot of also work to help you when possible, when it makes sense to connect your entity with the equivalent entity on Wikidata.
Mm-hmm.
Or to publish the same data that you create with WordLift on DBpedia. We are part of the DBpedia database, which means that if there are concepts that a client is publishing on its own website that we think could contribute to the broader knowledge, we would publish it into DBpedia, with links to, you know, back and forth from DBpedia to your personal knowledge graph and vice versa. And until now, though, it was, you know, the primarily use case was feeding Google and then starting to use this data on the information architecture of your website, because in our product, we started to create widgets for, you know, enticing people to click from one concept to another, to display maybe context card on a specific term in order to help people understand what we meant when we described, I don't know, semantic web or any other concept that we want to care about. But right now, it's even more interesting having this data. And it's interesting not just for the large organization, but also for the individual. Because if I have, you know, well-curated knowledge graph about the things that I have working on, then I can create an AI assistant that is fed in context with structured data. So ontology prompting and fine-tuning models with knowledge graph is what we have started to do since 2020. So it's now over 3 years that we work on these. And we had tremendous success. So structured data, finally, it's becoming way more important than Google itself. And if until now I had to prove the return of the investment primarily by looking at metrics from a third party that I do not have in the end any control, I can now show you that I can create better content if you have better data.
Yeah. And there's just so many different directions that we can consider in the last 20 minutes of this conversation. But let's sort of bring in the elephant in the room, which is so-called AI. And your product is AI-enabled. And let's think about your own personal information. How do you assert ownership of that information? How do you make your own information? You talked about how to make it more authoritative, but there really has to be territory that you stake out yourself. If you're like the anthropologist you mentioned, you want custody of this sphere of information that you're creating, and you want other people to have access to it, but you might want to impose certain restrictions on the access as well. Have you been thinking along those lines? Have people been asking you about that?
Only to some extent. So we know that we can apply a license to your knowledge graph, and this is helpful for understanding what can be done with this data that you're making available. But this year we are also starting to invest more on creating triples that are for private use only. Because until now, Google was for us, and Bing and the other search engine were for us, the primary data consumer for a structured data. But now, I see the advantage of, keeping something for yourself only that might not be made available to others. Mm-hmm. And reason is that in one of my latest blog posts, I created an agent that represent me as author of the blog post, and that allows you to chat with the content of the article and with myself as author. And I fed the system with everything that I've written on the blog, my personal entity on the knowledge graph of the blog, and that specific article. So there is an agent created with this orchestrator framework in that specific case. I'm using LangChain that has an index for the content of the article, an index for the previous content that I've written on the blog post, and then a system prompt that taps into who am I, and so my entity page content. Mm-hmm. And therefore, I am creating now an agent that acts as Andrea Volpini. And if you ask, who are you? It will say, I'm Andrea Volpini. I'm the CEO of Wordlift. But then you can also ask, okay, Andy, I don't want to read the article. It's too complicated or too long. Tell me, what is this about for, a travel agency or for an e-commerce brand? Explain me in layman's term for this specific target what you've written about here. And therefore you realize that the generative web, it's creating tremendous opportunity, but it's all about the data. Mm-hmm. And I like a lot this image that Tony Seal shared the other day, that AI is a tip of an iceberg, but the data underneath is what's creating, the actual wow effect.
Yeah, exactly. And it seems like trying to get all these different technology tribes to work in the same direction on this stuff is a huge challenge. I know something about the internet identity folks from the IIW workshop here in the Valley, and very smart people working on very smart things, but they're not working on what you just talked about. You know what I'm saying? It's like, how do we get all these people together to make a bigger impact than we're making? How do we get the tribes to work with each other better?
I think we had gone through a middle age on the web, and we are we haven't clearly realized it, that as Facebook and Google and the other technology stack emerged, we actually destroyed the ability of the web to become an interconnected ecosystem, and we devalue the power of interoperable standards, and the web identity, it's a beautiful standard, But the problem is that it's an island, because at the moment we kind of felt disconnected. And the same applied, of course, to our leader world of SEO. I mean, why shouldn't Google start to make its own entity in the knowledge graph dereferenceable and accessible to the, you know, using link data standard, if link data is what they use in the end to organize their information and to improve their information? And but we went through a middle age. We have went through a period of time where, you know, the corporate interest, you know, made it such that there wasn't any interest in sharing data, and there was no interest in sharing standards. And I do have hope that this will change, especially because AI, it's a beast on its own, and we cannot go through middle age in the era of AI simply because it would give tremendous power to few and limiting others from prospering on the web.
Yeah, makes a lot of sense. And sort of leads us to another initiative that we have percolating in our own little personal knowledge graph working group. And I don't know if you know Jury Lagos, but Jury is working on what he calls the Indie Web and the Indie Hub. And so he is trying to enable an open peer-to-peer environment based on IPFS that makes a lot of this setup automated. File system, as you know, that make it like you don't have to do as many things to set it up, but it's not really working as well as the traditional web has worked. Any thoughts on so-called decentralized web, or the kind of approach where you could start with your own environment and have your own access control in a granular way?
I think that the solid project by Tim Berners-Lee, it's something that we are starting to get ready for. And it goes kind of in that direction of, you know, decentralizing the architecture, because in the end, as you mentioned, it's very, you know, we have to start from the infrastructure before we get up to the, you know, the different layers into the apps. You know, if you know, the infrastructure it becomes decentralized, then it's easier to kind of share the value across the different peers. So I can see that, you know, that this evolution towards a decentralized semantic web, it's becoming a need, but of course there are a lot of other forces that are coming into play, and I think that still people are underestimating the value of knowledge in the era of large language models, because large language models are have been attracting a lot of the attention these days, and then we kind of lose again the focus on where is the data coming from, who owns the data, where is the lineage of this data, how do we, you know, track the usage of this data, what is fair use, what is not fair use, and we work with a lot of publishers, and so I started to, and of course we represent a company that does AI. So good or bad, you know, we do have a lot of visibility, but we do also get a lot of concern. And especially with creators and publishers, we went through in the previous months through real fear, because, you know, if all of a sudden people can generate your content because a model has been trained without you knowing it, that it's your content, then it gets scary, because it's obscure, and it's also, you know, there is a disalignment between, you know, the one that creates the data and the one that, that they use the data. And so, again, we need a decentralized web, and we need something like Solid, simply because in the context of artificial intelligence, you know, we can't let, you know, few companies control the internet.
Yeah, exactly. So we're talking at a level where the engineers are trying to do work and collaborate and create the kinds of alignment that you're speaking of. But let's just bring this back to the individual user one more time here. And so if you're reading about these things and you're wondering, now, what would you say to that person? I mean, say they've got a presence, but it's not structured at all. It's not, he doesn't, the person doesn't know if it's fulfilling the goals that, that the person has set out for their content. What would you, how would you start if you were that person?
So, in the 90s or early 2000, I would say to that person that he or she needed a website and couldn't, you know, build his own digital presence only through services provided by others. And, you know, right now, what I would advocate and what I would suggest is that any individual that wants to create an impact needs to create content and data at the same time. Because without data, you are going to be controlled by others that will train better models and would absorb, you know, whatever ability you might have or whatever expertise you might have. But if you start by creating your data, then it's like you are piling up some value or some you know, you're creating some assets that you can immediately create value with SEO, which it's still, you know, for me, it's a good starting point.
Yeah.
I still remain SEO driven and focused because I realized that SEO for me has been the way in which I could start to build semantic web without having to justify. And the same applies to an individual. I mean, are you using advanced SEO techniques for creating an impact? Because if you are not, you're missing out. And if you are, then most probably you are extensively curating data, because this is how SEO works in 2023.
Mm-hmm. So in essence, it sounds like the so-called metadata that you're creating is the key to your own personal control over what you're creating.
Yes, and you can measure the impact even at the individual level. I mean, because the features that you will trigger on Google, on Bing AI are so relevant for your personal reputation that you would see an immediate reward for that work on, you know, structuring content and metadata at the same time. So that's, for me, the starting point. Then you will realize that you're not really working for Google or for Bing or for whatever chatbot you are targeting. You are actually creating the foundation for your personal growth, because with that data, then you can train your own system. Then maybe you can work in context and personalize your digital assistant and whatnot.
Yeah, it makes a whole lot of sense. It really does. And so I've seen a diagram that Moz published in their tutorial on how to get started with SEO, and the schema is at the top of the pyramid. And then there are other things that create the foundation of the pyramid. So you're creating your content, but the schema at the top is really of saying it, or how would you say it?
I mean, the in the traditional SEO schema, mm-hmm. is an advanced technique because it's complicated, mm-hmm. especially if it's not automated and you have to write it in by hand. It's not, you know, the starting point. And plus, of course, if your website has indexation problems, there's no advantage in creating schema. Mm-hmm. So whether I could agree at some level that, you know, schema is at the top, I also start with schema at the bottom. Because when we create a, you know, an experience online, whether, you know, and today we can say it's a chatbot or it's a website, we start from architecting information and we start from looking at the personas that will access this information. When doing so, using a vocabulary such as schema provides you already with the insights on how you wanna organize your content. And so we can use schema not only at the top, but also at the bottom if we see mm-hmm. as a way of organizing, you know, the content that we're dealing with. For example, you know, you mentioned the cartoons or the comics. Now, if it's a comics book, what is the class that I can use mm-hmm. for describing the comics that I have worked on in the past? And how can I define the role that I had in each and every comics that that I worked on? Can I be classified as author, or am I a contributor? Am I a performer? You know, what is the label that I can use from the schema vocabulary to characterize my role within that that piece of work? So schema is also helpful for helping people think in terms of information architecture. And so you will have schema at the beginning and not just at the end.
You made me think of IMDb, the film database, video media database, but it has all sorts of information about the different roles performers have played over the years, but also whether Correct. They've been an actor or a director. And as these actors mature, they get more into directing and producing and that kind of thing. It seems like, you know, but does IMDb, not to denigrate them, because they've done a great thing by putting all this together and keeping it going for so long. It's kind of fantastic. But what's missing from IMDb that could make it or trying to build up their presence and their brand?
I think IMDb is, you know, de facto standard in the industry for, you know, that type of information. But of course, you know, how accessible is that data? How interoperable is that data? How, you know, connect is that data with other data? You know, they could have done a lot more there. If you think about it, Wikidata has had, of course, it's completely different projects, but has had a way larger impact simply because it's using open standards and it's accessible. Whether, of course, for IMDb, it's still, you know, privately owned. And of course, it's managed like a private database. There are some projects that kind of make that data accessible through linked data. But, I mean, mm-hmm. they could have done more in sharing that piece of information within other pieces of information, I think. But that's the principle. I mean, imagine if you could describe, like IMDb does, your work experience on your site, and you can do that using an interoperable standard, or, you know, like schema. What does that mean? It means that at the moment, if you need to create a quick and easy description of or biography, using GPT, you can feed into the prompt the schema class or the schema attributes, and then you can ask, you know, the model to describe your working experience to a 6-year-old or to another creator or whoever. But if you do not have that data organized and structured, every time you will start, recollecting memories on, what you have worked on in the past and so on and so forth. And therefore, you will not, create a sustainable system for sharing your expertise.
Yeah. And I know that Kingsley, for example, posts a lot on Twitter about how he's generating this entity schema information. And I'm wondering if you're just getting started, Kingsley, sophisticated, how do you do something in a more automated fashion to start building the graph?
So I think that we're currently trying to approach the two sides of the coin. So on one side, mm-hmm. we want to use language model for accelerating the growth and the nurturing of the knowledge graph that we create. Because, creating and maintaining a knowledge graph, it costs money. And using a language model, we can more quickly extract structure from mm-hmm. the structure compared to the old NLP technique that we used. On the other side, we are using the structured data in the graph to fine-tune language models. So private, dedicated language models that are trained with your data and your content. And by kind of combining these two processes, we can, very easily create, thousands of FAQ content or, hundreds of thousands of product descriptions. So use cases where there is a lot of volume and there is a lot of need for quality, but at the same time, there's no an economy for having someone writing, pieces of content. So again, the point is you need to have control over your data, because that's gonna, it's a game changer now. You can start to see that it's a game changer in SEO, but then you will realize that it's a game changer in anything that you will do with content or with search within, your strategy.
Yeah. Points today, Andrea. Thanks so much for edifying me on this and our audience. I will be summarizing this, and I'll send you an edited recording of it. It's just going to be audio. We're not going to post the whole video.
Sure.
Doesn't need to be video. But I may be back with you on your case studies, because I think those are really certainly relevant to what we've talked about, and it's helpful to us in many different ways what you talked about today. So thanks for the time today.
Thanks to you, Alan, and speak to you soon.